One Easter weekend, I was, I don't know, 10, my best friend John and I went down to the park by the Detroit River, where our city was having an Easter egg hunt. Here's what happened. The adults roped off a big circular section of grass. We all had to stand outside. Then some dude from the parks department just kind of walked into the middle of it all and dumped out a trash bag full of plastic eggs. At the whistle, everyone rushed in to get as many eggs as they could. This was not an Easter egg hunt. There was no hunting. It was more like a Black Friday doorbuster sale. It was chaos. I came away with two or three lousy eggs. I was too polite to survive the fray. John got a few more. If you ask me, the whole thing stunk. The Easter egg traditions here in northern Michigan, they sound way more fun. We're going to hear about some of them this week on the Up North Lowdown from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Ed Ronco. Our arts and culture contributor Joe Beyer and IPR's Dan Wanchura will unscramble all the egg traditions for us later in the episode. We'll also hear concerns about funding for the arts here in northern Michigan. But first, the trouble with trees. If you've been listening to previous episodes of The Lowdown, you know that northern Michigan was recently hit with a once-in-a-generation ice storm. We've done a lot of reporting all over the region about this and the efforts to address damaged infrastructure, but the storm also devastated huge swaths of forest. And while we think of storm damage as mostly having to do with structures and roads and power lines, there are a lot of people who rely on trees here. IPR environment reporter Ellie Katz tells us those folks are having a very hard time right now.
Bill Starrett is standing on the edge of his woodlot north of Gaylord. It feels different now than it did before the storm.
Normally, if we were standing here, we wouldn't feel the wind. We might hear it at the tops, but we feel the wind down here at ground level now. I'm not used to that because the forest is so open now. The wind is just coming through. There's nothing to block it anymore because the crowns of the trees, the tops of the trees are gone.
Starrett is a retired forester. He's carefully managed the trees here since 1989. When the storm came through, he hoped that management might help his woods fare a little better.
But no. And the first thing I saw was these pine right here. And I was looking for green. And I, you know, there's green up there, but it's not green like it was. They're almost, if I had to count, 80% of them are sheared off right at the top. And they're just standing there.
A little farther in, a hillside full of hardwoods, old sugar maples, oaks, and basswood, looks the same. Some tops were sheared off like the pine. Others look like they've been split by a giant, imprecise axe. Almost all of them showed the white inner sapwood that's usually covered by bark. Starrett was managing portions of these woods for high-quality, high-value veneer, used for things like doors, furniture, and cabinets. He estimates he's lost 90% of the value of his timber.
I'll get some return now from the salvage, but I hope I'm wrong. But yeah.
Salvage prices run about half of what undamaged timber would fetch, and there's no insurance available for timber grown by private landowners like Starrett. Loggers are swamped with requests to clear trees damaged during the storm before they lose even more value. But representatives with the timber industry say the region's sawmills don't have the processing or storage capacity for all of it at once. To put it simply, many trees will be left to rot. Unlike a tornado, which touches down and causes damage for a few miles, the ice storm damaged hundreds of square miles of forest, stretching all the way from Lake Michigan to Lake Huron. The Michigan Department of Natural Resources is still assessing the number of trees damaged.
This is really ballpark napkin type math.
Jeff Stamfly heads up the DNR's Forest Resources Division.
100 trees to the acre wouldn't be unreal.
Okay, that's helpful.
It's a lot. It's a lot.
It's potentially tens of millions of trees by that math. The state and private landowners are still wrapping their heads around the financial losses. And for vacationers and passersby, these woods will look and feel different for an entire generation. Tree crowns are completely or partially gone. Where before you might have been able to walk through the woods, you can't now. All that woody debris on the ground can create more diverse wildlife habitat, but it also provides lots of fuel for forest fires. Plus, Stampfly said some areas will likely need clear cutting.
In order to make sure that the next forest that we're going to have to grow back is as disease-free and is as healthy as we can get it. And by leaving partial stands that are busted up pretty bad, it's a real good vector for disease to come into the stand and impact the subsequent stands.
Meteorologists estimate the last time Michigan experienced an ice storm this severe was in 1922. But New England had one in 1998, and it prompted scientists there to recreate ice storms in a controlled setting, starting in around 2015. A group of researchers basically sprayed different amounts of freezing water into an experimental forest. Then they watched what happened. In the immediate aftermath,
the total height of the canopy came down, it opened up, and it was more, you know, ragged.
Lindsay Rustad is a retired forest ecologist with the U.S. Forest Service.
The longer term, you know, over 6, 7, 8 years, you know, we did see a greening up of the canopy, right? Our trees come back. They're incredibly resilient. They're tough. And so they put out more leaves. They filled in some of the holes in the canopy.
Despite that regrowth, Rustad said those trees are getting sicker over time.
They had to put so much of their energy into repairing, you know, the damage and the ripping and the shredding and everything that happened, that they were just in decline.
So now, researchers want to see whether this forest is more susceptible to stressors like droughts, heat waves, insects, and maybe more ice storms, which could become more frequent and intense under a warming climate.
And it's because of that that we feel that it's somewhat urgent to understand the impact of ice storms now and better understand how to manage our forest.
Only 2 weeks after Michigan's storm, though, people are still figuring out how to move forward. Jennifer Richard and her husband Troy produce maple syrup and other maple products in Gaylord. The couple took out nearly $500,000 in loans to start their business, Hidden Acres Sugar Bush, 5 years ago. It wasn't safe to check on their 17,000 maple trees until after the storm ended.
It was something you don't forget. But you're watching everything you build just crumble. And you didn't want to go look around the next corner because you just, every corner you looked around was destruction. You couldn't see, you know, the maple lines and its bright blue lines. You couldn't see them. You know, they were under thousands of treetops. And it was devastating.
Richard estimated it would take 5 or 6 years to clear all the debris and get the maple lines back up, running sap from their trees to their pump house. But volunteers from the Mennonite community and from other maple-producing regions of the Midwest helped clear trees and get some lines back up in a week. Still, they're bringing in less than a quarter of the sap they usually would this time of year.
But it's something, and if we can get to our bare minimums and pay our loans, we're going to keep going.
The Richards estimate they've lost about half of their sugar maples, which have to be about 40 years old to tap. But they won't know the exact number until they see what starts to regrow as the weather warms up. While insurance covers their equipment and final products, there isn't insurance for the trees themselves. They said they're looking into disaster assistance they might qualify for.
Our trees aren't going to recover for 30, 40 years. We're going to pass this business on to our kids.
Will it be there?
Bill Starrett, with the woodlot north of Gaylord, is also wondering what he'll have left to pass down.
For 30-some years, being here and loving the place and wanting to pass something on to my children, I mean, this is my legacy. This is, I mean, what else do we have in life if we can't leave something and make someplace better? And here, it's, you know, right now, it's not better. It's sick.
Starrett says he'll start replanting trees as soon as he can get the damaged ones removed. But for now, some things are already coming back. Buds, leaves, and the other usual spring arrivals.
Geese are coming back. I mean, I still hear, you know, the geese coming back and the sandhill cranes returning. But returning to what is the question.
IPR's Ellie Katz reporting. The cleanup and recovery from the disastrous ice storm is still ongoing, and Governor Gretchen Whitmer has requested an emergency declaration from President Trump. Congressman Jack Bergman, along with Senators Gary Peters and Alyssa Slotkin, supported that request. If granted, up to $5 million from the federal government would be available to help Northern Michigan. Now, we've been hearing a lot about federal relief money, and we got to wondering, how does it actually work? IPR climate reporter Izzy Ross explains that in a conversation with our producer, Max Copeland.
Hi, Izzy.
Hey, Max.
So, Izzy, walk us through how this assistance actually works.
So after a disaster hits, local, tribal, and state governments will typically be the first to respond. If they don't have enough resources to deal with the aftermath of a disaster, governors and tribal governments can request assistance from the feds. And it's important to keep in mind that FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, does not take any action unless it's requested by those officials.
So the federal assistance has to be specifically requested before anything else can happen.
Yeah, and how this response is structured goes back to this law called the Stafford Act. To learn more, I talked to Anna Weber with the Natural Resources Defense Council. She's a senior policy analyst, and she also spent a decade working on federal contracts on water infrastructure and environmental health.
There are incidents that obviously the state needs help dealing with, because no state or community can take care of it on their own. And that's when federal aid is designed to kick in.
Which is why we saw Governor Whitmer request this aid from the president.
So now what?
Ultimately, it's up to President Trump to decide whether or not to grant this relief.
And have we heard from the White House?
Yes. So we don't have a clear yes or no on the aid, but in an emailed statement to IPR today, White House spokesman Kush Desai said, quote, "The Trump administration is closely tracking the situation and is working with state and local officials to assess what next steps are needed," unquote.
But as far as the federal response is concerned, an emergency declaration is really just the beginning, right?
So the emergency declaration is typically processed pretty quickly because it doesn't need to meet any specific criteria. The president can just go ahead and declare it. The goal is to get aid to an area quickly, and it can give FEMA time to assess the damage to see if more assistance is needed. If that is the case, the governor can request a major disaster declaration, which would unlock additional federal dollars. And in a major disaster declaration, FEMA considers a range of criteria. Again, Anna Weber.
And those are criteria that are based on things like financial thresholds, so that states that have a lot of people and more money might be held to a little bit of a higher standard of like what counts as their own resources being overwhelmed.
Those assessments begin in this region in northern Michigan next week. And the way Weber described it, this work is very boots on the ground.
There'll actually be people out there driving around to areas that they can reach, you know, going, looking at things with clipboards, writing down the kinds of damages that we've seen in these areas, how much money it costs, and how many additional resources the state might need in order to address it.
If the region is eligible for major disaster relief, that's when other forms of aid come into play. For example, cash payments to individuals. That money can also help with immediate needs and more long-term recovery, like repairing public infrastructure. And there can be additional money available to lessen the impact of future disasters, like strengthening the electric grid.
So we're talking about federal dollars here, and it makes me wonder, with all the cost-cutting in the federal government, how is FEMA doing?
Yeah, just like everything else, there's a lot of uncertainty. Trump and those in his administration have said they want to drastically reduce or even eliminate FEMA. And Weber says FEMA staff have been let go and programs are being cut. Aid's also been slower to arrive, even if it has already been approved. Still, she says the big takeaway is that federal aid is meant to supplement what's already being done, so people can look to local governments and organizations for information and help first.
IPR climate reporter Izzy Ross talking with our producer Max Copeland. Izzy's work comes to us through a partnership with Grist. When we return, what federal cutbacks might mean for the arts here in northern Michigan, and Easter eggs.
These egg and Easter egg games seem to have a long colonial tradition in rural America where many, many different games could be played with the same hard-boiled egg in fun and simpler times.
Stay with us.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
I think one of the things that comes to mind first for me about why it's important to educate folks on the importance of native plants is because if you aren't drawn to it automatically, the default for our landscaping is to use like grass and sod and then other horticultural species that are largely not native. And that serves a function. Beauty serves a function. But native plants are both beautiful and they serve our insects and birds and are part of a greater ecosystem. It's easy to forget that grasses are flowering species just because their flowers are so different. So the grass I chose that I thought it'd be fun to share is the little blue stem grass. It's only like 18 inches to 2 feet tall. The ecology of little blue stem is cool because it can be nest material for birds. Bumblebee queens could use the base of the blue stem plant as a nesting site because bumblebees, there are some species of bumblebees, the queens will nest in the ground over winter.
You can explore native plants like little blue stem up close on April 28th at the Grand Traverse Regional Land Conservancy, starting at 5 o'clock. See you there.
Welcome back to the Up North Lowdown. I'm Ed Ronco. Local centers for the arts here in northern Michigan might soon go without critical funding. That's after the Michigan Arts and Culture Council announced it was stopping grant programs until the end of the summer. IPR's Michael Livingston is with us to explain why and how this might impact arts and culture in our region. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Ed.
Okay, first, what is the Michigan Arts and Culture Council, and why did it make this decision?
Sure. So this is an organization under the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, and the council's main purpose is to distribute any sort of state appropriations in the form of grants to arts organizations. It gets its money from state allocations, as I said, but also from some federal dollars, including the National Endowment for the Arts. And as the Trump administration has been looking to slash, halt, or disrupt these programs in some way, the Michigan Arts and Culture Council decided to put these grant programs on hold until budget time, which is usually in August or September. That was from a notification email from its director a few weeks ago, and in it she said, due to the changes in federal administration and shifts in state legislation, they went through and made this decision. And these grants can come in all shapes and sizes to fund different arts organizations. They can use them for just general operating things, you know, running a building, hiring staff, but also for, you know, small exhibitions and different programs that they run.
So to be clear, these grants are on hold, not totally eliminated, but the concern is, it sounds like twofold. One, that there's sort of some uncertainty right now, and also that there might be a trend to cut this funding into the future.
Exactly.
Okay. I think a lot of us have heard about the big changes in federal spending, but they said changes in state legislation as well. What are they referring to there?
Well, we don't know that yet. I did reach out to the Michigan Arts and Culture Council to get some clarification on why they made this decision and what they're talking about there. I'm hoping to clarify and update that soon.
Michael, how do these annual grants help arts nonprofits up north?
Well, yeah, as I said, it's hard to be an arts nonprofit without receiving some amount of MAC funding. Even IPR used to receive MAC dollars at one point. It's used for operations, staff salaries, but also for individual exhibits and programs, everything from, you know, keeping a building open to Maybe a pottery class could be funded with MAC funding. Places like the Oliver Arts Center in Frankfurt use it to maintain its historic building. I spoke with its executive director, Tamara Hofbauer, about this.
Painting, roofing, as well as purchase new equipment for special programs. We've been able to outfit some of our internal studios with equipment that we've been able to purchase with help from the state and federal funding as well.
Okay. Did any of the art centers you talked to say how they plan to adapt if the worst happens, if these bucks go away completely?
Yeah, all of them said they would have to rely more heavily on individual donors and private philanthropies. But that realm will undoubtedly become more competitive, and most arts nonprofits are too small to dedicate a full-time staff person to, you know, courting those donors or seeking out more grants or fundraising. I spoke with Charlevoix Circle of Arts about this. Its executive director, Sarah Monte, says it is definitely going to be harder to fight for the favor of these large donors.
I've seen data that just says that there's no way that can ever keep up or replenish what government funding does. So it's just, I think it's just going to affect the whole nonprofit sector.
Yeah, it seems like this would have a deeper impact, Michael, in rural places like Northern Michigan than in, say, Detroit or larger cities, where I'm sure they're going to feel it, but there's also a bigger pool of donors and other sources of money.
Yeah, up here in Northern Michigan, we have a lot of these small arts organizations in our small towns that collaborate on a lot of big projects. You know, you walk through a downtown area and you might see, you know, an arts gallery or just a place to gather. Those are the places that are feeling this here in Northern Michigan. And that's a lot different than, say, you know, a Detroit Institute of Arts or a Detroit Symphony Orchestra that might just have a tough year.
There are a lot of debates going on right now, and maybe this is central to the whole question of federal funding about, you know, what is the government's role? What should the government be funding? What case did these arts organizations make for why their nonprofits, other nonprofits like them, should receive funding? What's their argument?
Yeah, it's a good question. And yes, you can make the argument that maybe the government shouldn't be funding the arts, but a lot of these executives say that the arts industry is sort of a sleeping giant economically. You know, you think you come to Northern Michigan, you go to the beach, you go on a trail, you walk through the woods, but what are you going to do on a rainy day? And that's what these people say, you know, is what the arts are for in Northern Michigan, a place for people of all backgrounds to come together and share their love of art. The arts are a draw for people to get out to their communities and spend money at surrounding businesses too. And that's something the Denos Museum Centers talked about in relation to Traverse City.
They're going to shop in the store. The store is stocked with local artists' goods and items that are produced here in Michigan. So all of it has kind of a, you know, a ripple effect through our local economy.
That was Craig Hadley. He's the director of the Denos Museum Center in Traverse City.
That's IPR's Michael Livingston on the impact of grant funding from the Michigan Arts and Culture Council that is now on hold as the agency plans for anticipated cuts. Easter is upon us, so we are wrapping up this week's episode with this conversation between IPR's Dan Wanshura and arts and culture contributor Joe Beyer.
Here comes Peter Cottontail, hopping down the bunny trail. Hippity hoppin', Easter's on its way.
Eggs, and specifically how much they cost, has been in the news a lot lately. But this week, we're thinking about all those vibrant and sometimes plastic ones as Easter weekend approaches. With a long and colored history, these eggs will be rolling all over Northern Michigan, too. And here to tell us more is IPR Arts contributor Joe Beyer. Hi there, Joe.
Hi, Dan.
Thanks for hopping in studio today to talk about Easter eggs.
Very nice. yes, this is not a story about the Christian holiday, but instead, I guess, about how all these traditions around Easter eggs are enduring. Easter egg hunts, Easter egg rolls, coloring and dyeing your own Easter eggs. And I thought, well, let's look at that. And so Paz, the famous company that makes the egg dye kits that many of us grew up with, they've actually been around for 140 wow. years and still selling millions and millions of those kits each and every year. So this is still going on.
That's crazy. Joe, I remember years where we couldn't find the Paz dye, and it was quite the problem because, you know, the alternative just wasn't as good. Those eggs weren't as vibrant once you dyed them.
No, never. Only trust Paz.
Yeah. So before we get too deep into this, what are the basics here, Joe?
Well, obviously, everything is related to eggs here. And in the old days, keeping those eggs from breaking was sort of the objective. The main holdovers now are Easter egg hunts, which are exactly what they sound like, and Easter egg rolls, which usually involve sort of controlling the egg on a downhill slope or a hill, something of that nature.
Okay.
Most of these experiences are obviously related to eggs, and in the old days, how to keep an egg from cracking. So Easter egg hunts are exactly what they sound like, and Easter egg rolls usually involve hills and trying to control the egg on the way down.
Okay. Joe, I understand a lot of what we picture here might actually come from White House Easter egg events, which have, you know, been a presidential staple. You always see the news stories about it. Some people think it goes all the way back to Abraham Lincoln.
Well, informally, these egg and Easter egg games seem to have a long colonial tradition in rural America, where eggs were obviously pretty handy, and many, many different games could be played with the same hard-boiled egg in fun and simpler times. But the lore is that First Lady Dolly Madison was the inaugural person to suggest hosting an Easter egg event in 1814.
Okay.
The first one took place on the grounds of the Capitol building, and evidently the crowds wore out the turf so badly that Congress actually passed a law to protect the lawn.
Oh, wow. What an extraordinary response from Congress there.
Well done, Dan. Yes, it takes a turn after that, and President Rutherford Hayes either felt charitable and wanted to open the grounds of the White House to the people, or as some believe, he gave in to angry mobs that demanded it. But either way, most historians seem to agree that the first official White House Easter egg roll took place in 1878.
Wow.
Yeah. So since then, it's become the largest public event that takes place at the White House. It's always been a celebration of children who get to come and experience the day of fun with the president and their family. Dan, during the Nixon administration, some of the eggs evidently were not found until several months later, causing some sulfuric concerns. And that's when the White House switched to wooden eggs, which are really beautiful keepsakes. They have the presidential seal on them. And the whole thing for a long time was underwritten by the American Egg Board, a nonprofit that obviously had a lot to gain from this.
Oh, sure. Joe, it's funny you mentioned that because I swear there was a year at my grandma's house where we didn't find all the eggs and it showed up like 3 months later just smelling and rotting and everything. So from that point on, number the eggs. Make sure you're accounting for all the eggs so you don't be so... You don't get surprised weeks later.
No, I think that was a common experience for some of us growing up, yeah.
Okay, so that was then, Joe. What about here in northern Michigan this spring?
Sure. There are dozens and dozens of these events all over the region. Photo ops with the Easter Bunny that benefit Humane Society work, to a bunny hop 5K and 1 mile run in Charlevoix. Too many Easter egg hunts to mention. 2K Ciders even created a Easter candy pairing guide for adult beverages. But the first ever Easter egg roll sort of interested me because it's coming up at the nonprofit Mount Holiday Recreation Area, and it's going to feature 2,000 eggs.
Wow, that seems like a lot of eggs. I'm picturing them just rolling down this hill at once, sort of chaos ensuing. I'm guessing it gets pretty wild.
It's exactly what I was told by Chris Remy, who's the program director there at the park, and he has years of experience working on Easter egg rolls from working at Crystal Mountain in Benzie County, where they did this for a long time. So when he joined the Mount Holiday group, I'll let him tell the story.
the first time I sat down with the board, they're like, well, we got this program committee. We have all these ideas we want to do. We want to do an Easter egg thing. You know, this is like my first day. I'm like, I know how to do those. I've done those all the time. There's like a specific vendor. There's like one in the Midwest that you can call to get these eggs. We started talking about it just before Christmas. I was like, well, if we're going to do this thing, I got to order these eggs now because these guys get like hit, you know, we'll see how it goes.
Again, 2,000 eggs, Joe, that's a lot, but I understand that's not even the biggest Easter egg-related event here.
No, not to be outdone, I found that the Frankfurt Easter egg hunt will feature over 3,000 eggs. That's been going on for 15 years. It's put on by the Chamber of Commerce and the Downtown Development Association. The state record actually was 2022 in Lake City, Michigan. They had over 60,000 eggs. So. Yeah, a lot going on. And everyone involved, Dan, told me you got to get there early and you have to be ready because after weeks and weeks of planning, the actual event is over in about 5 minutes. Oh, it's very fast and furious.
Joe Beyer, thanks so much for cracking this one open for us.
Dan, you've outdone yourself. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Interlochen Public Radio.
Oh, yeah.
And that's it for the lowdown. We had contributions this week from Ellie Katz, Izzy Ross, Michael Livingston, Dan Wanchura, and Joe Beyer. You heard Max Copeland earlier in the episode. He's our producer. Music is by Blue Dot Sessions, and that egg song just then.
Humpty Dumpty was a big fat egg.
Playing the wall, then he broke his leg.
Eggman by the Beastie Boys. I'm Ed Ronco. We leave you this week with an excerpt from If Shoes Could Talk, a new podcast from some middle school students in East Jordan, Michigan.
Today, we are driving into the world of motorsports with none other than Mario Andretti, a name synonymous with speed and success.
Hi, my name is Vic. Have you ever had an epic fail in your career?
Failure per se, yes. But I mean, epic failure would mean very public, you know, embarrassing, perhaps humiliating, even subject to ridicule and disgrace, you know, something like that. I mean, in my career, I never even looked at failure. I looked at failure to be a setback. You know, no matter how hard you work, sometimes you just can't pop it over center. But you know what? You don't give up.
Hi, my name's Addison. I'm in seventh grade, and my question is, have you ever gotten a speeding ticket?
If I would have got a ticket, my dad would have probably killed me. So I had that deterrent. But later on in life, I got stopped a few times, but somehow I was able to weasel out of it only because, you know, they understood that I have some expertise about driving a car and then I didn't put anybody in danger. So they told me, don't do it again. And I said, I promise you, I will never do it again. So I got away with it.
IPR's Michael Livingston has been helping them produce these episodes. We think it's pretty great. Find If Shoes Could Talk at iprnews.org or through the same app you might be using to listen to this podcast. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.